From New York City, survival capital of the world, this is Radio Doomsday Live. I'm your host, Mike Luckman, and my special guest tonight is Dr. Ramon Lopez. He's a distinguished physicist from the University of Texas at Arlington, and we're going to be talking about the solar maximum, which peaks in 2013, and which some scientists have warned could pose an imminent danger to the nation's power grid and put an end to the world as we know it. Dr. Lopez is the author of a popular science book called Storms from the Sun. So we've got the right man on the case. I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Lopez, to the show.
Thank you very much.
The first thing that I would like to discuss is the, essentially the question is this: do we have anything to fear from the sun, do you think, based on your information, going into the solar maximum, which peaks in 2013? Because NASA scientists have repeatedly been telling us for months now that this could be a real problem, and that the power grid could be knocked out in a worst-case scenario.
Well, yeah, in a worst-case scenario, we could have some severe damage to our infrastructure. There's no direct indication that we're going to have such a worst-case scenario, but it's always good to be prepared for the big storm, right? You know, you don't want to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, now we're coming to you from. I'm based here in New York City, and of course, we just went through. I was personally endured five days without power, which is quite an experience if you haven't gone through it before. And so it really drove home dramatically what life might be like for a prolonged period of time, possibly months, perhaps even years, so some experts are saying. Now, of course, we're not talking about 2012, which is almost over, and we're not really talking about the Mayan calendar in relation to this. But what we are talking about is that the solar maximum does, in fact, peak in 2013. While my understanding that there's a solar maximum every 11 years or so, we are seem to be in a particularly powerful or potentially powerful solar maximum based on these flares that have been coming increasingly, it seems, more toward Earth. They go the other way normally, as you would know, but they seem to be coming more toward Earth, and we've had some glancing blows, and we've even had some instances of radio communication blacked out in certain places, but it hasn't been, you know, across the board, fortunately. The question is, what do you think we should, you know, expect in the coming months, and particularly going into 2013, how bad might it get?
Well, actually, this coming solar maximum is going to be weaker than the last solar maximum. The sun seems to be entering in a phase of slowly declining activity, and there are a number of scientists, myself included, that wonder if the sun is going into what's called a maunder minimum, a period of prolonged minimum solar activity. But even if solar activity is a little bit weaker than it had been in previous solar cycles, you still have the possibility of a dangerous flare or coronal mass ejection that, if you're not prepared for it, can damage your damage the infrastructure. The thing is that we've become more and more dependent, not less dependent, on space technology and on our electrical power grid. And so as you become more dependent on something, then even small damage to it can have a significant impact on your daily life. So there have been a series of reports that talk about what are these worst-case scenarios, and you really do have to prepare for those. I mean, what could happen in the case of a superstorm? There's no real reason to believe that we're going to see a superstorm in the coming solar maximum, particularly mm-hmm. because that solar maximum is going to be less powerful than previous solar maximums.
But Dr. Lopez, isn't it true, though, that things keep changing, I mean, very quickly at times on the sun? And there have been some peculiar things that have been happening over the last, I guess, year or so, including there were sunspots, then there were no sunspots. Then there was a, I remember seeing even a photograph of or a video of a sunspot that was, instead of round, it was square. So things can change very rapidly.
Well, even during periods of solar minimum, you can have sudden magnetic activity on the sun that produces one of these flares or coronal mass ejections. But in general, this coming solar maximum is going to be less strong than the last solar maximum. You can just look at the number of sunspots as an indicator of the magnetic activity of the sun. And you know, back in 2008, 2009, we went to this very long, extended solar minimum that was really unexpected, that we would have so many days. We had more days without sunspots than we've had for a century.
But now, isn't it true, though, that, I mean, I know that I've read reports, even in the last number of months, of solar of flares that have come, as I said earlier, delivered glancing blows to Earth that could have been quite damaging if they had come just a little closer, I guess, to Earth, or been just a little more powerful. So why are we being warned by NASA scientists repeatedly that there is a danger of the power grid going out?
Well, because the danger is real. I mean, even moderate activity, if you're really depending on something, can have an impact. Mm-hmm. There was loss of a communications satellite not too long ago due to not super activity, but just moderate activity. So even moderate activity can still have an impact. Our society is just becoming more and more dependent on things like space technology, and our electrical power grids are becoming more and more interconnected. And as a consequence, there's an increase in fragility. So these warnings are to remind the community at large that, yeah, this does exist out there, and you have to be prepared for it. Actually, the power grid companies have made significant progress in using space weather reports to modify what they do. I mean, back in 2003, we had a series of really very powerful big magnetic storms that did not crash the power grid, in part because the power companies were aware that they were coming. And, you know, I used to live on the Atlantic coast of Florida, so I used to bookmark the hurricane data center all the time and
right.
take a look and see what was happening. And if you have got warning, then you can prepare. Now, we've built up a lot of infrastructure on the coast, and the value of coastal property has gone up. And so now, you know, when we have storms, hurricanes hit our Atlantic seaboard, we can have significant economic damage because we've built up those areas that are vulnerable.
Are you familiar with the Carrington effect?
With what?
The Carrington effect.
Are you mean the Carrington storm of 1859?
Yes. Could you tell my listeners a little about that?
Yeah, that was a huge monster superstorm. I mean, it probably is the largest magnetic storm that we have in the historical record, so that is to say the past couple of hundred years. And that one knocked out telegraph communications in Europe and North America for the better part of a week. Aurora was seen as far south as Havana, Cuba, and recorded by a U.S. Navy warship off the coast of Nicaragua. If such a storm were to occur today, we would have really serious damage to our communications infrastructure, and it's quite possible that large sections of the North American power grid could fail completely, and some of them it would take quite a while to recover because you'd blow up.
When you say quite a while, are we talking about weeks or months or longer?
Up to months. Yeah, mm-hmm. Up to months. That was the worst case scenario that was discussed in the National Academy of Sciences report a couple of years back, if we had a Carrington type event.
When can the nations
but
of the world...
There's no indication that we're going to have a Carrington-type event immediately. I mean, there was an interesting study that said that we had one in 1972, but that the magnetic field in the cloud was pointing the wrong way, and it didn't produce a superstorm at the Earth.
What can the nations of the world do to prepare for this eventuality?
You need good prediction so that you know when something is coming, and then you have an idea of what the possible effects would be. And then you can turn things off. I mean, in some cases, it really is that simple. You turn stuff off for a couple of hours and let the worst of the storm pass. And then you can turn your spacecraft systems back on, and they'll be okay. With power grids, the power grid companies need to be aware that a huge storm is coming so they can balance loads on their grid and not let things cascade out of control.
Mm-hmm.
So prediction. It's the same thing with hurricanes. You know, back at the beginning of the 20th century, there was the horrific Galveston hurricane. It wiped out Galveston, killed thousands of people. That's because they had no idea it was coming or how big it would be. If you have prediction, if you understand what's coming and what the possible effects are, then you can mitigate.
Well, now, the sunspots, I understand, drive our weather. As you know, the weather lately and for quite some time now has been really extreme, and extreme weather is becoming the norm. What role do you think the sun is playing on that? With that, and what do you think the immediate future holds for us as far as the kinds of environmental disasters that we've been facing lately?
Well, weather and climate are two different things, and weather is what happens day to day, and climate is patterns over years. There does seem to be a link between solar activity and climate, although what exactly that link is, it's not completely understood, and there are a lot of scientific arguments about it. People have proposed particular mechanisms, and it's an active area of investigation. But as far as like day-to-day weather, I mean, there are people who wanted to blame Hurricane Sandy on all manner of things. I mean, that's really difficult to point to a specific cause of an extreme weather event. Mm-hmm. And day-to-day variations on the sun really don't create our weather here on Earth. There are lots of other factors that create our day-to-day weather. But long-term solar changes do affect long-term climate changes here on Earth.
What are your views, Dr. Lopez, about the greenhouse effect?
Well, if there was no greenhouse effect, Earth would be frozen. Because if you do just a simple calculation of, how much sunlight comes in and how much should be radiated out, if Earth was just a black body not trapping any heat, then you find that the average temperature of the Earth should be, a little bit below freezing. So the fact that we've got water vapor and carbon dioxide and methane in our atmosphere is what keeps the Earth, from being frozen. Earth did freeze over in the ancient past. There were a series of periods where Earth completely froze over. Glaciers covered all of the Earth, and in fact, all the oceans froze over. This is called the snowball Earth hypothesis, and so it has happened before.
Are we living in a pre-ice age, an interglacial period?
Oh yeah, we're in an interglacial, without a doubt. The modern climate record has been one of repeated glaciation, repeated ice ages. We're in one of those warm periods between ice ages. And eventually we'll go back into an ice age.
We've got extraordinary melting happening in Antarctica and in Greenland. I mean, unprecedented melting. Obviously, the sun has plays a major role in that, don't you think?
Yeah, the solar variations play a big role in climate, and so does the human impact. I mean, we are changing our atmosphere by pumping a lot of carbon dioxide into it, and if we could find economically viable ways to produce energy without producing as much carbon dioxide, that would probably be better. Because what we're doing is we're doing an experiment that we don't know what the outcome will be. But the sun is driving our climate as well, and changes on the sun, long-term changes in the solar cycle, which is not completely understood. those are going to drive climate changes as well.
Both the Mayans with whom I'm in touch with, and also the Hopis, feel that when the poles melt, that's the time, and they say it's every 24,000 years, and it may sound way out to some people, but nonetheless, I think it's kind of plausible, and I'm wondering from a physicist's point of view, what do you think about the possibility of a pole shift, which incidentally, Albert Einstein apparently thought was something that could happen.
Are you, people use this phrase pole shift to mean a couple of different things. Most often, the context is a change in the magnetic field of the Earth, that the magnetic field of the Earth will...
Well, what I'm talking about, though, goes beyond that, too, the physical, the outer mantle of the Earth where it slips and suddenly here I am in New York one minute, I'm in Russia the next.
That's not very likely, because there's just so much momentum in the Earth, so much angular momentum, that the actual direction of Earth's rotation isn't going to suddenly change by a very, very large amount. The magnetic pole does reverse direction, and it does so every, couple hundred thousand years, but that process is a multi-thousand-year process, so it's not something that happens overnight. Even if you take all of the ice, all of the mass that's locked up in ice in the polar regions, and then melt it and redistribute it on the Earth, yes, you will change a little bit the orientation of the rotation of the Earth. You would change a little bit the time of Earth's day, because if you redistribute the mass, you can have a slightly different rotation speed of the Earth. But it wouldn't be huge. You're not going to, as you described it, be in New York one day and then in Russia the next.
So you think it's highly unlikely that scenario might go down?
Yeah, you can do calculations that in fact, I could have students in my introductory physics courses, the engineering students could do these kinds of calculations, and they would see that no, there's just not enough motion of material there to make a huge shift in the direction of Earth's rotation.
Okay, I want to ask you about your book, Storms from the Sun. A popular science book. First of all, how can people get a hold of it?
Well, you can actually get it for free. It's now available as a free PDF download, so you can put it into your Kindle or whatever if you want to just read it. And the easiest way to get it is just to Google Storms from the Sun, and it should come up on the first page of hits. It's through the National Academy Press, and we sold out of all of the hardcover books some years ago, and Mike Karlowitz, my co-author and I, Mike and I decided we might as well just make the book available for free. And so now it is available for free. If you just Google Storms from the Sun and just follow the links, it'll eventually get you to the National Academy Press website, and you can just download it.
Okay, good. What are some of the issues that you get into in your book, Storms from the Sun?
Well, one of them is something that you raised, the Carrington event, this enormous explosion on the sun that happened at the, well, actually, it was a series of explosions at the end of August and beginning of September in 1859, mm-hmm. that was really the first huge space weather event that humans encountered. We've been living with this phenomena forever, but until we started manipulating electricity and magnetism to do things that were important to us, until we started building large conductors that would span thousands of miles, we never ran into these problems. But here in 1859, you had the telegraph, and the telegraph was the internet of its day. I mean, it just really transformed things. And you had telegraph wires that would cover, hundreds and thousands of miles. And so you had these big conductors that could act as antennas for all of this energy that was always up there during magnetic storms, but we had never encountered it before. And it really did make a huge impact on people of the day. You can imagine people down in Florida or in Cuba all of a sudden seeing the sky on fire. Mm-hmm. They must have thought the world was coming to an end. because they've never seen that kind of thing before.
Right.
Or for our economies at the time to be dependent on the telegraph, and then telegraph is unusable for most of a week. It was a really, really big impact. And, you know, that level of storm, if it happened today, that would have a potentially very serious effect on our economy. That was the case that was studied by the National Academy of Sciences to come up with this potential $2 trillion in economic losses.
But you think there's almost no chance of that happening today?
You can never tell. Like I said, though, there was a very interesting paper that came out a few years ago that made the argument that actually we had one of those in 1972, but the magnetic field in interplanetary space, the direction is really critical for how much energy actually gets into the Earth system. Because if the magnetic field in the cloud links up with Earth's magnetic field, then you get a huge amount of energy that comes in, and you get the huge magnetic storm. It's pointing the other way, and they don't link up, then the cloud just sort of blows past without much of an effect. So this paper argued that in 1972 we actually had one, but the field was pointing the wrong way. And so we dodged that bullet.
Do you yourself put any importance on the Mayan calendar, which I've been hearing so much about? The Mayan calendar, of course, is counting down now. It's amazing. We're only a week away. To December 21st, 2012, the last date on the Mayan calendar. Do you think it has any particular significance? And if so, what do you think the importance of that calendar might be?
It's no more significant than our year 2000. You know, people were worried about the Y2K bug and other possible effects of that year 2000 boundary, but nothing really happened. It's the same thing with the Mayan calendar. It's just the rolling over of their long count with the end of a baktun, a cycle of 354 days, and now it's going to roll over to a bunch of zeros in the next.
Okay, but so now while it rolls over, I've been in contact over the last 2 years with some leading Mayan elders in both Mexico and in Guatemala. In fact, some of them have been guests on my show recently. And what they're telling me, and this basically is not something that they're shouting about, but they definitely believe this very strongly, is that these, what they expect will be spiritual changes that will begin to unfold starting on a week from Friday, December 21st, will be all kinds of natural disasters. On a scale of biblical proportions. I mean, they're talking about some like outrageous possibilities. They believe you may not, but they believe in Planet X or Nibiru, a rogue planet. I happen to believe in that as well. They, as I mentioned before, believe in the possibility of a pole shift, that Planet X or Nibiru is supposed to come around about once every 3,600 years. It's not been sighted yet, or it's been sighted by, some people claim that they've sighted it and even taken photos of it, but there's nothing convincing evidence, except NASA certainly has been tracking Planet X, the same, very same planet, for many years. In fact, an associate of mine, Dr. Tom Van Flandern, who was the chief astronomer of the United States Naval Observatory, made the government's initial announcement about finding Planet X all the way back in, I guess it was in the mid-1980s. And there have been all kinds of reports that have come out in the New York Times through the years, New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, places like that, about the... Planet X. Do you have any feelings about the existence or non-existence of Planet X?
There is no Planet X. I just have to be very clear about that. If there was a Planet X, we would have seen it. And, you know, we know how many planets there are in our solar system and what other, you know, at least close in, we know about a lot of the bodies. Little stuff, we can't tell for sure. In fact, we had an asteroid that came by just a couple of weeks ago that wasn't seen until it was very close. Now, it wasn't a huge object. It was, you know, the kind of object, sized object that caused the Tunguska event in 19...
Wasn't there also one just the other day? It was a large one that came by, and
that's the one. But that was not a, shall we say, something that will produce an earth.
No, not definitely not.
That was just a small
asteroid. But Ramon, there have been reports by credible science writers in different publications, including the New York Times. John Noble Wilford did a story some years ago about a object that originally was felt to be on the outer edge of our solar system that was, you know, creating forces on other neighboring planets, and that you know, some feel is on its way back.
If it's on the outer edge of our solar system, then its orbital period is going to be far, far more than 3,000 years. So if there's some large object out there, and as far as we know, though, there's not, but if there was some very large object out there that would perturb the orbits of other things, we would know about it. We would have seen it. After all, we found lots of objects through the gravitational perturbations that they produce on each other.
Yeah.
So that's how all the outer planets.
But my friend Tom Van Flanden unfortunately passed away this last year, but Tom made the government's announcement for the U.S. Naval Observatory. He was chief astronomer. And since that time, in fact, even in recent period, there have been reports that have come out about, quoting astronomers, about not that planet X is at our door, but that there is a planet X or Nibiru or whatever you want to call it, some kind of a dwarf star that truly exists.
No. Sorry,
there's no
large planet out there. Anybody who's saying that is really quite mistaken. There's absolutely no evidence that there's any other large body in the solar system that we don't really know about it.
Well, so that, well, are these erroneous reports? You may not have read the specific ones that I'm referring to, but through the years in New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, and lots of other places,
I'm very cautious about scientific things that appear in newspapers, because there are a lot of times people get things a bit wrong. Again, there's no planet Nibiru. There's no large body in the inner solar system that we don't know about. I mean, there were at one time. In the early history of the solar system, these things did exist, and they got all cleaned up. I mean, planets smashed into planets, and you know, Earth had its encounter with a Nibiru, if you will, 4 billion years ago. Earth collided with a Mars-sized object, and that's what made our Moon.
Are you familiar with the late Sumerian scholar and author Zechariah Sitchin, a man who popularized belief in Planet X?
No, I'm not familiar with him, but you see, just the way you put it, popularized the belief in a Planet X. These are not scientific ideas, because in science you rely on evidence and observation, sometimes experiments if you can conduct them. In astronomy, it's very difficult to conduct an experiment, but you have observations. And we know perfectly well there is no planet Nibiru. This is a myth.
Okay, so do you think that the images in the Sumerian tablets that show another planet is all part of a myth that has no reality to it?
Absolutely mythical. To begin with, the Sumerians had no idea what objects in the sky really were. They certainly had no idea of things like planets versus stars, and you know, the whole, I mean, the word planet is a Greek word that means a star that wanders, because those...
Well, according to Sitchin, who lives here in New York and who I knew pretty friendly, the Sumerians knew not only each planet, but they knew quite a number of things about the planets. They knew basically how the planets moved, their coloration, their relationship to one another in terms of size and distance. They knew quite a number of things.
No, they didn't know any of those things. Sorry, they did. What ancient people were very clever, and they needed calendars to survive, because that's how you record plantings and all of that. And in an agricultural society, having a calendar is critical. So they knew that certain objects in the sky had certain patterns, and they knew, you know, when the sun would rise and when would be equinox and solstice, mm-hmm. and all of these things. And they made very careful calculations, very careful observations of remarkable precision. That doesn't mean that they really understood anything about what they were actually seeing. They had no concept of the Earth as a planet. I mean, the Sumerians didn't know that the Earth was a sphere. That didn't exist in their cosmology at all. They had no idea about these things. So trying to take modern understandings and filter ancient legends through that is a real mistake, because that's not how they viewed things at all.
Ramon, are you familiar with the TV show Ancient Aliens?
Yeah, I've seen that.
Have you seen it? Okay, well, it's one of the most, I think it is the most popular show on History Channel. The question I have for you is all this stuff made up? Is it all myth? Is there nothing to any of this? This kind of information that's presented on, and the claims that are made on ancient aliens, where you see apparent spacecraft and aliens and all of that. I mean, it's remarkable, really, the similarity of some of these cave drawings and other images made, you know, by different ancient cultures all over the world.
So you can easily take a selection of different images and try to link them together, but basically there's nothing to it. I don't believe any of this ancient alien stuff at all. If we had contact, there would be some real evidence. Carl Sagan once said that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
You know, I'm going to tell you about Sagan. I can't quote this to you right now, Ramon, but I got to tell you that I just read a quote, and I think it's an authentic quote from a letter that Carl Sagan had sent to somebody, and I think it was somebody in authority over in England, possibly at the palace, having to do with crop circles. And he referred in his letter to real crop circles as opposed, obviously, to hoaxes. And we know that many of them, in fact, the majority of crop circles, if they're not all hoaxes, at least the majority of them are. But what's very interesting, Ramon, is that some of those crop circles have testing has shown that there have been changes in the corn and the wheat at the molecular level. So where how does that occur? So, you know, the crop circle thing is just, you know, part of a bigger picture, but I wanted to segue into a brief discussion. I don't know that you're an expert on the sun. I don't know what you have to say about Mars, but since you've done some work with, I believe you've done some work with NASA, I just wanted to ask you about Mars, specifically the, you know, we're given like little dribs and drabs of information from NASA regarding what's coming out from the different missions. But Tom Van Flanden and myself produced a video, a DVD called, it's still available, called Life on Mars, the latest scientific evidence. And it included, or really featured, photographs, official NASA photographs, showing some amazing things. We've all heard about the face on Mars, but let me tell you something. There's not just one face on, so-called face on Mars, a human-like face on Mars, but there are several, and there's one in the Ceres Major area. I don't know if you're familiar with it or not, but you could look it up on the Internet, in which I was responsible for bringing that to the attention of the news media. The New York Post ran it almost a whole page, and that'll give you some idea of how real it looks. It could be your next-door neighbor. And it's an overhead shot, of course, looking down, and NASA dismissed it just as rocks. But if there are rocks, there's something about Mars where the rocks suddenly form faces. Tom Van Flanden found out that some of the photographs show, and his colleagues found that some of the photographs show animals, carvings of animals, large carvings of animals. And what's particularly wild is that these animals appear to be grouped by species. Now, I don't have any idea if these carvings are real, what purpose that would be for an ancient Martian civilization, why they would go through all that trouble. But nonetheless, the pictures show that. And moreover, the pictures show endless tunnels, glassy type tunnels darting in and out of the surface of Mars. There are pyramidal structures and things along those lines. So
do you want my reaction to all this?
Yeah.
It's all nonsense. I'm sorry. I am quite familiar with Mars exploration, and I have colleagues who do that kind of work. And all that you've described, there's zero evidence from the imagers. I mean, it's like the face on Mars, okay? The face was just a particular point of view where shadows were cast in such a way that somebody says, hey, wow, it looks like a face, and became the face on Mars. And anybody can just Google face on Mars, and you'll see the pictures. And there are other pictures taken from other angles that show that this is just, you know, just an illusion. So everything that you've described, I don't know where you're getting this stuff.
Well, I can tell you without any question
that none of these things actually exist. As far as the question of life on Mars, it's a very interesting question, because Mars was once warm and wet, and wherever there's water on Earth, there's life. So the question is, did life take root on Mars? If it did, it was only at the cellular level, at the microbial level. There certainly wasn't enough time on Mars for life to evolve into multicellular life, into animals and things that could actually...
The possibility of insect life?
No. Consider the fact that if you came at any time in the history of life on Earth over the past 4.5 billion years, it would only be in the last 0.5 billion years that you would see anything other than microbes. For all the other time of the history of life on Earth, you know, 80% of the time of the history of life on Earth, it was all microbes. And it took a very, very long time before large creatures evolved. There simply wasn't time on Mars before Mars lost all its water and became what it is today. So there might have been life on Mars. There would have been, what would have stayed at the microbe level, because the amount of time necessary to evolve big creatures.
Okay. Ramon, what do you say when I tell you that we were talking about UFOs a little while ago and extraterrestrials, whether there's any evidence of visitation to Earth. I once had a conversation with Dr. Bill Gutch, who was a meteorologist who then became the head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York. They were having a program about extraterrestrial life. I contacted him to become a speaker, a possible speaker on one of his panels, and he made it very clear that he didn't believe that UFOs were real in the sense of that we're being a visitor or anything like that. But what do you say? You're a scientist, but what do you say when I tell you that I have 400 videotaped depositions by former military guys who served in the Pentagon mostly in the 60s and 70s who say, flat out, UFOs are real, we're being visited, the governments of the world know about it, there's a massive cover-up, the Roswell crash was real, they've had personal experiences with UFO sightings, and on. And furthermore, that they're prepared to go before Congress to testify if they're granted presidential immunity. Now, this isn't scientific evidence, but it certainly is something intellectually to get a hold of, to get a grip on. And what do you say about this? Do you think they're making all that up?
No, I don't think people necessarily make stuff up. But sometimes people see something that they don't quite understand. Then they will construct some explanation for it.
But 400 military guys?
Ah, wait a second. You say you got 400 military people with depositions. I mean,
yeah.
I could go back to 15th century Europe, and I could find you literally tens of thousands of eyewitness accounts of witchcraft. There was this wave of
witchcraft. Well, you're not comparing this to witchcraft, are you?
I don't believe in witchcraft either. that's the whole point. Maybe a pilot sees something he doesn't quite understand. He sees some phenomena he doesn't quite understand. So he constructs some UFO explanation around it. And you will get, I'm sure you can get hundreds of depositions for something around UFOs in the same way that you had many, many people who were absolutely convinced that they had direct evidence of witchcraft for which you should burn people. No, I'm sorry. You can't have mass delusions in societies. You can't have ideas that propagate and some people grab onto them and they become very powerful ideas for those individuals and they become a way to explain some experience that they had that they can't explain in any other way. It doesn't mean that on an objective level that is a true explanation. So UFOs, in my view, as visitors from other planets, are no more real than witches were in Europe in the 1600s.
But you realize that you're making a very negative comparison here.
I'm not claiming that these people are making anything up. They are certainly believing and sincere in their belief that they had an encounter with an extraterrestrial visitor.
Well, actually,
what I'm saying is that is not an objectively true statement.
Well,
and that there's no evidence
that
these things are objectively true.
Yeah, it actually goes a lot further than that. I've spoken, for example, with Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut, and he had a meeting at the Pentagon with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and one of the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff told him, answered his question regarding the Roswell thing, that it actually, that crash actually happened, and there's a lot more evidence that backs that up, but that's for another show. I wanted to wrap this up by focusing on this this very unique period that we're in a week from now, December 21st, 2012. Now, if you don't buy the end of the world thing, and I certainly don't, by the way, I don't think that it's the end of the world on December 21st, although it's startling to learn that the results of a poll conducted by the Reuters news agency recently that determined that 10% of the world's population, I think in the United States it might have been as high as 20%, actually believe that the world is going to come to an end on December 21st. This is just unthinkable. The world's not going to come to an end. I happen to believe personally that we're living in the end times, and that the extraordinary weather anomalies that we're having is linked to that, and whether that's as a result of planet X or the sun, or any combination of other things, there's no way of telling, really, but I do believe that. However, the Mayans also talk about, and this may not be scientific, but the Mayans also talk about the a spiritual time coming of an enlightened new age, which may or may not be felt on a on a physical level. Do you think there might be a grain of truth in that? Is there any likelihood from where you stand of that sort of an ascension of man's spirituality occurring, or do you not buy that?
Well, first of all, that's a question that's not really addressable as a scientific question. Well, I'm not a Mayan expert, but okay. I have read quite a bit. If I were not a physicist, I'd be an historian, and the Mayans are of particular interest to me. My understanding is that their views on these, turning over of baktuns, these cycles over 354 years, is that there would be, some kind of changes, but it would be more like you described, sort of spiritual or intellectual changes, because actually the long count calendar has dates after, December 21st, 2012. So obviously they put down in their calendar the existence of the earth and the world after that particular date. I have absolutely no evidence that there's going to be anything particular or unique about December 21st, 2012. And I personally don't believe that there will be anything particular or unique about that date. You pointed out this large number of people who believe that something is really going to happen. And, actually, if a large number of people believe that something's going to happen, that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, it could, but I want to ask you, the weather's been getting so much out of control, and I mean, we've never experienced the kind of weather that we have now in our lifetime. What are you doing, if anything, to prepare for, these worsening natural disasters? People are prepping, they're storing food and water. And let me tell you, even I was caught off guard when I thought that I might be without electric when they first called and said they were turning off the electric. I thought I might be without electricity for 24 or 48 hours. It turned out to be 5 days, and some people, I think, were still in the dark in the greater New York City, New Jersey, Connecticut area. So are you doing anything special, not around December 21st, but just in general in this time frame, in the coming months and years, to prepare for any kind of, emergency conditions?
Well, you say doing anything special. First of all, I believe that everybody should be prepared for emergency conditions. It's a really good idea to have a stock of some bottled water and some foods that can be prepared very easily, some canned goods that don't go bad.
Right.
You never know when something really disastrous could happen. And just in general, people should have be prepared for events, because as you described, I mean, people up in New York were without power for many days. I have a little inverter that I can plug into my car so I can charge my cell phone and laptop if we lose power completely. That's just a good thing to have. It's a good thing in general to have some basic disaster prep stuff in your home, no matter where
Absolutely.
You live.
Absolutely.
When I lived on the Atlantic coast of Florida, we would always have stuff because we had hurricanes. And so you never knew when you would be without power for an extended period of time. And so, in general, it's a good thing to be prepared for, some kind of disaster. Now, some people go overboard and build entire bomb shelters and stuff like that. That's not me. But having some bottled water on hand, having some canned goods that aren't going to go bad, that you can just eat straight out of the can, having an inverter for the car so you can power up your cell phone and still make phone calls if your electric goes down for a few days, all of those things are good ideas.
Okay. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ramon Lopez, for being my guest on Radio Doomsday Live. Dr. Lopez's book is Storms from the Sun. And one more time, where can people get a hold of that book?
It's at the National Academy Press. And if you just Google Storms from the Sun and then put National Academy Press or NAP after that, It'll take you right there, and you can download the PDF for free and put it on your Kindle.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Lopez, and maybe we'll get you back sometime soon and continue this discussion.
It's been fun. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I want to talk about December 21st, 2012, the Day with Destiny for the Human Race. And I want to update you on some late-breaking developments that are tied in with the belief of the Mayan calendar. Now, nobody ever said that the Mayan calendar predicts the end of the world, or some people have said it, but they've certainly been mistaken. There have been news reports filtering out of China, France, Russia, and various parts of the United States, suggesting that people are going a little nuts on this very important and timely subject. They're really going overboard. In Russia, people are buying candles, which is not, of course, is not a bad idea, but there's not going to be any blackout, particularly on December 21st. But they're buying up candles wholesale in both Russia and in China. Of course, the Russians love their vodka, and they're getting big supplies of vodka to either celebrate or drown their sorrows, whatever they might think could occur on December 21st. But from my very first show about 6 months ago all the way to tonight, I keep on repeating, be calm, stay calm. There's not going to be anything terrible happening on that date. Of course, on any particular date, there could be an earthquake or some kind of a natural disaster occurring somewhere in the world, but there isn't going to be anything that even comes close to being an end-of-the-world event. You might be interested in learning what some Hollywood celebrities have been doing to prepare for December 21st and these general end times that I believe that we're living in. Tom Cruise has spent $12 million on an underground bunker. He believes in an intergalactic, he's a member of Scientology, of course, he believes in an intergalactic, an evil intergalactic ruler. This is something right out of science fiction is going to invade, and that he needs to be prepared for himself and his loved ones. And so he has this very elaborate bunker that's capable of housing about 10 people for a period of a year or longer. I also understand that some Hollywood stars may be buying or may have actually purchased shares in other underground shelters, even missile silos, believe it or not. And I can tell you that Ashton Kutcher, Leonardo DiCaprio, Kiefer Sutherland, and Angie Harmon have all been purchasing survival supplies at a place called the Survival Value Center in Los Angeles. Ashton Kutcher, I'm reliably told, stocked up on $4,000 worth of survival gear, and he's bought things like emergency blankets, high-powered flashlights, emergency water rations, and ready-to-eat meals. Now, I want to end this program by mentioning a man who was with NASA, getting an extraordinary amount of publicity lately. His name is David Morrison. He's a NASA astrophysicist. And Morrison has made some videos. These are official NASA videos. And he's denied the existence of Planet X. Well, it's certainly his right to do that. They're downplaying now the problems of the sun, which Dr. Ramon Lopez, my guest on the show just a few minutes ago, may or may not agree with. He says that nobody knows really for sure what's going to happen in regard to the sun, but Dr. Lopez himself thinks it'll be a fairly mild solar maximum that we're getting into in 2013. But what really upsets me is that David Morrison, by the way, I invited him to come on my show, Radio Doomsday Live, and I just got a response back saying no thanks. Now, he's claiming that 25 million Americans are stockpiling guns and machetes in anticipation of December 21st, 2012. Now, you might have gotten that 25 million Americans figure from the Reuters poll, but there is no proof, there's no evidence whatsoever of any large number of people in even approaching 25 million stockpiling guns. And where did he get this machete thing from anyway? He's really off the wall, and he needs to be taken to task. He says he's concerned about people being frightened about December 21st, particularly small children. And here he goes around making these highly irresponsible statements. Finally, I want to go on the record as predicting a significant number of UFOs that will be sighted, in my opinion, in major world capitals next Friday, including New York City. December 21st, 2012, certainly is a date that has captured the world's imagination, the world's attention, and soon will usher in, hopefully, an enlightened new age for 7 billion people of Earth. Be sure to tune in next week's show, next Thursday night, December 20th, transitioning into December 21st, the Mayan calendar end date, and this is going to be a very, very special show. I hope you'll tell everyone to listen in. This is Mike Luckman signing off.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I am a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world to the dumb needs. Dummies serve your own needs. Speed it up and not speed.